The following podcast contains descriptions that some listeners may find distressing. Any opinions expressed are all our own and do not in any way represent the opinions of where we work. Just a quick announcement, check out our friends Capable Podcast, who are an amazing true crime podcast discussing what the human race is capable of. So you can check them out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Hello and welcome to Mad or Bad. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Neil, and we're excited to be bringing you the story of the Irish asylums today.
It's a particular interest for me, as you may have noticed from my accent, that I grew up in Ireland, and many of the places that we will talk about, I have grown up around or have heard many stories about. And really, I think the history of psychiatry in itself is super fascinating, and also really dark. And it's really hard to believe that some of these places only closed down in the late 90s. So we'll start off from the very beginning, really. Going back to the 1800s and 1900s, there was this massive epidemic of asylums in Ireland. I think at one point there was about 20,000 people in all of these institutions being treated for mental illness. Interestingly enough, according to some of the first published history of psychiatry in Ireland, there wasn't necessarily an epidemic of mental illness in the country during that time. Instead, there was a load of different political, social and other factors that kind of combined to this high number of people being admitted to mental health wards.
So do you think then, although we're saying 20,000 people were in institutions supposedly being treated for mental illness, it was just somewhere to stick people?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the sheer number of people in the institutions meant that ill treatment was absolutely awful. But really, when you looked at the actual people who were in the institutions, they weren't always necessarily mentally ill. You know, a lot of them would have been people who were homeless or people who their families just wanted to get rid of, actually.
I guess the ill treatment bit, I suppose you're going to go on to talk about that, but was it ill treatment per se, or was it just because at the time, you know, they didn't know really what they were doing?
I think possibly chaining people to walls would be classed as ill treatment. We'll get into that. So before we look at how the asylums actually were, I think it's really interesting to look at how Irish people made sense of and how Irish people treated mental illness way before these asylums actually, you know, came up in Ireland. So one of the main things that people did was they thought that they could be mentally cured by drinking water from a well at Gianigel.
Somewhere in County Kerry.
It was said to contain high levels of lithium, which is quite interesting, actually, because we do treat people with lithium.
Yeah, lithium. However,
there was also other things. So there was this inquiry in 1817, and it revealed the most common ways of treating people that family members had, because all of this treatment was done back in the community before the asylums were actually established. And one of the things that people do would be to dig a pit in the ground of their hut or their home. They'd put the mentally ill person in there, put a grid or a grill across the top, and simply feed the person in this pit.
Feed the person what? Just feed them anything?
Cows. The butcher gave them meat.
Oh, right. Okay.
The baker gave them bread. A farmer gave them a field to sleep in.
So presumably that didn't work.
I don't think so. Bizarre, though.
Yeah, I mean, supposedly, you know, Industrial Revolution and that, obviously Ireland, perhaps not, you know, at the time, not as advanced as England or whatever, but surely...
Stick them in a hut and they'll be grand.
Yeah, I just don't see how that could ever be, you know...
Yeah, so, but when you go back to those times, I mean, there was no science, there was no understanding of mentally ill. It was just like, stick them in a hut and hope for the best, maybe. I don't really know. It's bizarre.
Maybe.
So looking at when the asylums actually started to establish themselves. There was quite a lot of really large asylums, first of all. So I think ones in Enniscorthy, Letterkenny, Mullingar, these were some of the biggest ones. And then Cork and Dublin kind of came a little bit later. And a lot of the issues, as you were asking before, why, you know, were these people mentally ill, or were they, you know, were there other social reasons? A lot of it was around employment, actually. Initially, these were workhouses and they were prisons. And these people were just sent there to work and kind of, you know, get out of the way of their family in a way, if you know.
I mean, I don't know if anyone listening's ever sort of seen any of these. I'm talking about in England or anywhere where somebody's listening. But I mean, I started working in the mid 90s in what was called an asylum, you know, in years gone by. And even in the mid 90s, this is in England, in the Midlands, you know, it was like a mini village in itself. You know, they had like its own cricket club and social club for the staff and the patients. And in years gone by, they had a farm where they used to work on the farm. You know, they were massive places. And in a city such as Derby, which is a small city, actually had two asylums. There'd be one for like the county of Derbyshire, and then one for the city of Derby. You know, so that's kind of, I mean, this is England, I know, we're talking about Ireland, but there were absolutely loads in England at that time.
And it's interesting, I think, to go through the history and kind of look at how, yeah, they had an awful name, especially in Ireland. I'm not too sure about the UK. I think pretty much the same story, really, later, I think. So just looking at, because I actually, when I looked into the asylums, I presumed that the Catholic Church had a lot to do with it. But apparently, the Catholic Church was nothing to do with the asylums.
That's quite odd to believe, isn't it?
I know. I think in a way, though, it's about the culture in Ireland and, you know, whether the Catholic Church was, you know, directly involved or not, the culture was that of a Catholic culture, and that was very much embedded into the culture, whether we liked it, definitely. But just quite interesting that, you know, while the church is most definitely far from blameless in many other areas, but that actually it was entirely the government that ran these public institutions. So I think that's quite interesting that it challenges some of the narrative of Irish history, really.
And I think I have to say as well, don't we, you know, it's always easy for anything, no matter what you're talking about, to criticise it in hindsight. Obviously now, in, you know, 2019, nearly 2020, things have moved on. And and some of these practices that we're going to go on and talk about just seem, or, you know, you're putting someone in a pit and feeding
them. Barbaric.
Well, it's just like, you just, you know, what's the point, you know? But at least they're trying to do something, I think.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's important to acknowledge that, you know, every practice has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, that's it. It doesn't just arrive, does it, in the year 2020 or whatever.
Yeah, and a lot of these asylums came from prisons, actually, and workhouses. And, you know, they might have had their own lunatic ward or like a room or an area, but eventually they became kind of their own freestanding psychiatric unit.
And I guess as well, you just spoke about workhouses. I mean, there was one quite local to here as well that is a hospital now, actually, and it's obviously all been converted, but that was a workhouse. And I remember looking in the like local library, you know, years ago, about some first hand accounts of people that were in this workhouse, and they, you know, as awful as it could be, it possibly would have been a lot worse if they'd not been in the workhouse, because they were getting fed.
Yeah, and it's a sense of purpose as well, isn't it?
I don't know whether they saw it as a sense of purpose at the time, but
yeah.
But yeah.
I guess.
So in Ireland in the 1820s, anybody could be committed directly to one of these asylums on the evidence of another. So the Dangerous Lunatic Act of 1838 meant that a person could be arrested if they were seen to be, or, you know, deemed to be a danger to themselves and or to others. And they'd go to jail first and then to the, you know, whatever was the nearest asylum.
It kind of says it all, though, when you talk about, you know, committed and arrested. It's,
well, it's,
you know,
a language, isn't it?
Yeah. Which obviously we don't use that language anymore. You don't say, you know, someone commits suicide.
No.
And it's, it's obviously really, you know, it's really good that we don't use that language anymore. But it just shows, it just goes to show kind of the thinking at the time was,
these
people are criminals.
And I think there's still, I know we'll get into this further, but there's still, you know, a long way to go, I think, you know, now, today. But I think talking about some of this just goes to show how far it has come.
And where it's come from, I guess.
Yeah. So the level of poverty in Ireland at that time, and obviously it got worse, was it in the 1860s, Rachel? Potato famine, was it?
I don't know.
Well, it, I think it was something, yeah.
Was never my strong point.
No,
but...
well, you know, it was a bit later on anyway, so these things even got worse, but the levels of poverty at the time, you know, 1838, around that area, and the impacts, of the famine later meant that in the 1800s, there was a massive pressure on asylum beds. You know, they were always full. So 1838, the Dangerous Lunatic Act.
You're a lunatic.
A lunatic. Also meant that, so as I've said, somebody could be committed to an asylum without medical opinion. So, you know, it's not like today where, you know, you need, you know, we'll go into this another time, but, you know, you need two doctors.
So it's just basically, hey, Neil, I think you're insane.
Yeah. It's been said.
I'm going to speak to, I don't know, the policeman.
Yeah.
And he's going to arrest you and off you go into jail and then off you go to an asylum.
Or maybe it wasn't even just a policeman, you know. Maybe it could just be someone that was seen as...
I just ship you up at the door.
No, maybe it could be like, I don't know, the bank manager or something. I don't know.
Or the priest.
Yeah, something. Someone that was held in high esteem or something in the town or whatever.
Mm.
So somebody without any medical sort of knowledge at all. So it wasn't necessary to have, you know, any kind of medical certificate for a magistrate to commit someone to an asylum. All that was needed was their opinion, who, as we've said, more than likely, or, you know, have no medical knowledge at all. It could have been someone said that, you know, so-and-so from number 55, he's a lunatic.
I don't think they had door numbers back
then,
Neil.
Well, you know, from the arse down on the corner.
They still don't.
He's a lunatic. So far, we've predominantly spoke about Ireland. And just to give a bit of context and comparison, so what was it like in America around this time? Well, there's a chap called Benjamin Rush, and he's sort of considered, well, he's written about now, but he was considered then as sort of the father of American psychiatry. And he was really one of the first, or the first, to abandon the theory that demon possession caused insanity. He did come up with some,
interesting treatments.
Yeah, interesting treatments to help, you know, cure their minds, I think was the words. So instead of letting out demons, he thought that the body's fluids were out of balance. So he bled his patients, he induced vomiting, and you know, we thought that would release, well, you know, that would cure the person of insanity. There was a chap called Henry Cotton, who was superintendent, was basically in charge of New Jersey's Trenton State Hospital from the early part of the 20th century. And he really believed that infected parts of the body led to mental illness. He looked at kind of pulling rotting teeth, which he actually thought caused madness. I mean, obviously, you know, it can cause infection, sepsis, and kill you, but he specifically thought madness. He then went on removing tonsils from that as well. And then he even went further than that. He started removing parts of stomach, small intestine, appendixes, gallbladders, thyroid glands, and parts of the colon. Any place where it was thought that any kind of infection could linger and sort of, I don't know, fester.
I'd imagine a lot of people died from this.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, obviously very high mortality rate. It's very difficult, isn't it, to think, you know, today, why removing parts of the stomach would cause mental illness. But then again, we're looking at it through the knowledge we've got today. So, inspired by the discovery that high fevers help stop the symptoms of advanced syphilis, so there was a chap called Julius Wagner Juhlreich. So he experimented with inducing fevers in people with schizophrenia by injecting them with malaria-infected blood. In fact, he was even so well thought of that he got the 1927 Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine.
Good for him.
He was the first ever awarded for the field of psychiatry.
Killing people with malaria.
Yeah. And then, so the kind of the next sort of treatment that gained sort of popularity, if you like, after the sort of injecting with malaria, well, was insulin shock therapy.
Basically, I think this is probably a bit more well known than
I think we'll go on to it, but I think this went on for quite a few years, quite sort of popular in the UK as well. What happened with this was high levels of insulin were injected into patients to cause convulsions and a coma. Several hours later, they would be revived from the coma and thought cured of the madness. And this kind of procedure would be repeated daily for months at a time. There's loads of stuff, information available on this, but it does, you know, obviously it was very risky and it did cause amnesia, but it's kind of the mortality rate, although it depends where you read, it did seem to be getting a little bit less, although whether it was cure, you know, which I guess is successful in one way, but whether it's actually curing any, however you want to call it, mental illness, madness, lunacy or whatever, that's another thing entirely.
Well, if you weren't mad before that, you surely would be after.
Yeah, or dead.
Mad possibly. Or dead.
Yeah. So coming to the wards towards the end of the 1930s, just before the Second World War, so a treatment that got popular then and still continues today is electroconvulsive shock therapy, so ECT. You know, this can be traced back to the first century when the Romans, they used torpedo fish and basically held it to someone's head to induce electric shock, and that was used for...
They basically shock somebody on their head with a fish.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, you know, basically it's to kind of induce a seizure in the brain. I mean, have you seen this?
Yeah, I have actually. I've seen it a couple of times before. It seems to be primarily older people that I saw it with who are like experiencing, you know, really bad depressive symptoms, not able to eat and drink. Really poorly, really, and you know, they've obviously tried everything, every kind of medication, and nothing has really helped. And to be fair, I mean, ECT is not like what you see on telly. It's not like that, you know, those big electrodes on your head.
I think when it first started, I think, you know, people used to get fractures and you know, broken.
Yeah, because they didn't use muscle relaxants.
Yeah, that's right. Whereas if you actually see that...
I mean, you don't even... Like, when I saw these people having ECT, you wouldn't even know they were having it. Like, you don't see anything. They're just asleep, like they were going to have surgery or something. And I know people have said, you know, from their own experiences, for people that it works for, it works really well. Yeah. And
I mean, over the years of people that I've seen, that I've kind of nursed that have had the treatment, at best, it has lifted... mood.
Yeah.
At worst, it's not done anything to the mood, but kind of short term.
There is things like short term memory loss.
But as regard, I think
and fuzzy headedness and stuff.
Yeah, but I think you know, it's a topic for another time. You get fuzzy headedness for
from being depressed anyway.
Yeah, or missing an antidepressant tablet. But that's another. Around the same time, so you got ECT coming in. Around the same time, doctors. Primarily in America, performed the first lobotomies. And basically, it kind of required neural connections in the prefrontal cortex of the brain to be damaged. And those connections were thought to be the cause of mental illness.
Didn't they initially start this with like an ice pick through the eye? I'm serious. I think that's actually
although
how
then
they
again,
started.
It does sound... No, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I know the ice pick rings a bell. I don't know if that's from some kind of horror film or what.
Baby Laurent in the background. Just a cat playing with his what is rat. Toy rat.
Your Baby Laurent is a cat. Yeah. But yeah, so and I can remember again going back to sort of the mid-90s, starting working at what was deemed an asylum. You used to see a lot of patients that had been there for years, and you could tell sort of the telltale kind of scars and sort of indentations.
Well, where did you see the scar
then? On the head. Well, it was just kind of like the forehead. Place where the indentation is, sort of to the side, yeah. Right, sort of the
I've never seen that.
But the idea was that if you could damage those neural connections in the prefrontal cortex, was that you could stop the, you know, the
damaging aspects of memories or personalities, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I guess it's interesting because it was a very physical thing to do to somebody's body, and it probably reflects how they thought about mental illness, was that it was a physical ailment and not so much a psychological thing.
Yeah.
And it is quite interesting.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I think to a large extent that sort of belief still exists today.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So we've kind of gone through the ages of psychiatry, but I just wanted to go back and talk about more in depth about actually how the asylums were and how, you know, what they were like. And really, they were quite awful. And this is back to Ireland and the Irish asylums, but I'm sure it could possibly reflect, you know, other areas as well. Yeah. I'm sure it. So in 1934, there was an inspection of some of the hospitals some of the asylums around Ireland. In particular, St. Mary's in Cork, which is one that is now closed down, thankfully.
But it's still standing.
I think they've turned it into apartments or something. Yeah. But I mean, it was open till 1998, so that's kind of crazy in itself. So there was this report that basically published that the asylum had no soap or towels. There was no curtains on the windows. There was no seats in the toilets. The toilets were absolutely filthy. And patients' own money was used to buy washing machines for the other patients in the ward. One of the inspectors called at about 5:30 in the afternoon. Again, there was no curtains in the dormitories. There were sheets of plywood being used to cover all of the broken windows. Some of the people were incarcerated in units that were roofed like a stall. And there was doors that were almost like farmyard doors, which is just bizarre.
And when's it? Oh, this is safe.
This is 1935. Yeah. And going on a year from that, again, they had another inspection. And the inspectors basically reported that there was no activities during the day. Patients just sat around waiting for bedtime, which is really sad. There was rubbish, litter.
That's what we do.
There was rubbish, litter, toilet rolls discarded around the exterior. The corridors were dirty beyond description. Inside walls were peeling, windows were dirty, and again, toilets were filthy. A quote from one of the inspectors said, "The service provided by the hospital is extremely poor, and for the most part appears to provide the worst form of custodial care." You know, other quotes were that the facilities there were appalling, distressing, disturbing, and offensive, and this really confirmed that the hospital was an absolute disgrace, really. You know, the people incarcerated in the asylum were guilty of nothing. They shouldn't have been incarcerated to begin with. Mm. And they were incredibly vulnerable, you know, very innocent, and most of the time very harmless, and they didn't really deserve anything that was, you know, done to them there.
I can remember, you know, where I used to work, like I say, mid-90s, there was a lady there that had been in, she'd been in there since about, I remember, I think it was like New Year's Day, 1956. So it was like 40 years, and I think it was because she had a child out of wedlock, you know.
Yeah, really common.
And she'd be, all that time.
Crazy, isn't it? And there was other descriptions of patients being restrained with manacles, locked on their ankles by a chain so that they could be fastened to a bed, and they were subjected to bizarre experiments. I did also read that there was...
experiments? What?
I'll tell you in a minute. I also read about people being handcuffed behind their knees, like their hands behind their knees, and for so long during the day that actually they weren't able to walk anymore at all, and people thought that probably they would never regain that kind of walking ability. And there was some...
Because they were violent or something. Well, we don't know, do we?
I think it was just because it was that prison kind of
thing.
Culture of you chain your people up. And they weren't patients or people. They were very much inmates. So you were asking about bizarre experiments. So there was one in particular in Cork that was particularly popular. It was started by a psychiatrist called Dr. William Halloran. And basically he used this contraption where the patients were placed in a chair and they were sat in a chair or they could be lying down and they were rotated at high speed, like 60 times a minute. And according to this psychiatrist, and this was 1810, I believe, the swing generated a sufficiency of alarm to ensure obedience in the melancholic and it provided a natural interest in the affairs of life.
I mean, it's just
bizarre.
So we found some information on particular people that actually ended up in these asylums. And in 1892, there was a lady called Dora. She was 34 at the time. She was a servant, single, unmarried, from Dublin. And she was admitted to the Central Criminal Lunatic Asylum. And she was charged with the murder of her 8-month-old child. Her previous 5 children had all died young. And in the... where we found this, the asylum's casebook, it records that some days before the crime, Dora suffered from a violent pain in the head. She felt as if the top of her head was splitting open. On the morning of the crime, so killing the child, she took the child in her arms and left the house. She wandered off some distance from home, did not know where she was or what she was doing. She imagined that she was followed by a large crowd of sailors and people. She was diagnosed with melancholia and delusions of infestations, although she actually had a brain tumour. So she spent 14 years in that asylum before being sent for the rest of her life to another asylum, at which point she was miserable and demented, never speaks, takes no interest in anything and stands about in a semi-dazed condition.
Yeah, that's sad, isn't it?
Well, that's just one...
The asylum that she ended up in was the Richmond Asylum in Grange Gorman.
Is that...
Which, it's quite infamous, really. So if there's any Irish listeners, it's in Dundrum, I believe.
Is that near Dublin, then?
Yeah. Mm. So that's really sad, isn't it? So finally, I think we just wanted to talk a little bit about a lady named Mags and her experience after the asylum, really, after the asylums had closed.
So how things are now, pretty much?
Yeah,
living
pretty
in community in her own place?
Yeah, that kind of a thing. So this lady, Mags, she suffers from depression and a lot of anxiety as well, but it looks like she's had a really poor history of trauma. I'll read out some excerpts of her life, really. So shards of memories tumble around her head. They are of rough and tumble years spent living on the streets, unprovoked assaults, bloodied noses, crack houses and pimping. It all seems part of one chaotic mess. Then the faces of her children, the girls she never knew, taken into care because she couldn't cope. So it's really awful. This lady goes on...
And she couldn't cope because of an illness, obviously. It's not a defect of her, is it?
Yeah, a lot of trauma there. And she says, but the bad days still come, and when they do, it can be overwhelming. Depression is terrible. It's rotten. Look what it's done to me, she says. I'm destroyed. I've used myself like a human ashtray, stubbing cigarettes into myself. There are sometimes all these thoughts of self-harm in my head. I talk to someone and I feel okay. Then an hour later, it's back. It's like I'm slipping back into the past and I can't see a road ahead. So up until recently, Ireland's mental health system dealt with people such as Mags through institutionalisation and drug treatment. And that's been for a really long time, as we've already discussed. You know, people were locked away in asylums behind high walls. And that was what we did. We just, you know, we were really good at brushing everything under the carpet and locking people away. But obviously things have changed. And today most of these institutions have closed or ceased admissions. I know the one in Cork, St. Mary's, was closed in 1998.
I mean, I think it's important just to finally say that although we've pointed out a lot of, you know, what today seems... very sort of inappropriate at best, but very cruel treatments in asylums. I used to work seeing patients who now live in community that once lived in asylums, and quite a few used to say to me, you know, that they feel more isolated now than what they ever did, you know, when they were, you know, when they were living in these big asylums. And whilst I'm not advocating, you know, me personally, I'm advocating going back to a situation where we, you know, stick patients back in, you know.
But some of them did have a sense of community, and it was about being with people who understood, I think, where, you know, what you were going through.
That's
and there's
right.
something to be said about that. It wasn't necessarily the other people working there. I think it was the sense of community
and a
sense of belonging, actually.
Very, very vulnerable, lonely people. And I think it'd be a different matter, I think, if the community services were perhaps as they should be. But I think they're very stretched.
They are very stretched, and, you know, it's only getting worse, really.
Yeah.
But let me just go on and speak about Mags a little bit more. So today, how Mags dresses depends on her mood. Today, she's wearing black, splashed with a riot of primary colour. Morning begins in the kitchen, helping to bake scones and feeding some of the animals. Later on, other residents will come back from the bakery and they'll sit down and catch up on the events of the day.
So Mags must live in some kind of...
Yeah, at this point, Mags lives at a place called Shlí Ella. I've actually been there myself.
Is this the rehab place you said about?
I don't even think they call it rehab. I think it's just this community kind of therapeutic environment. It's really beautiful. It's in the middle of the countryside. You know, they have their own bakery. They have chickens and animals and gardens, and people live there, and they, you know, they attend.
Is this place still open?
Oh, yeah, as far as I'm aware, yeah.
And how big is it?
It's not that big, I don't think. Yeah. I don't know how many people they take in.
Nothing
or
like
whatever,
the size of it, but,
but it's all about, you know, replacing your empty days with support, you know, a routine, getting involved, keeping busy, having a sense of purpose, really, and looking past the symptoms of mental illness and looking towards just living as a person, really. Whether that's with support or live independently. I think, unfortunately, she did leave after 2 weeks. Mags wasn't able to cope there. It just wasn't the right time for her. So it really just encapsulates that care in the community can be quite complicated. And what works for some people may not work for others. And really, you know, there's lessons to learn from the closing of these asylums, whether it's in Ireland or the UK.
I think I said earlier on, I think the cynic in me, though, is I think the primary driver. Was it for the patient's benefit, or was it to save loads of money?
What, the asylums?
Off? Yeah, no, to close. Because although we still call them asylums, you know, they were hospitals.
I would like to think it was for the patient's benefit.
I don't know.
But the issue was, though, that, you know, you can close all these asylums, but they didn't replace it with proper community services
to keep these people.
It?
I mean, there are community services, but they're understaffed and under pressure. So.
Yeah, and that's a whole other argument for a whole other day, but it's a complicated one. So that is the end of the episode today. We hope you have enjoyed it. As always, you can find us on facebook.com/madorbad. Twitter @madorbadthepod. Please subscribe and leave us a review. See you next time.